If the individual was listed in a computer file, which everyone inevitably was, then the subject quickly landed in her spider's web. If the individual owned a computer with an internet connection, an email address, and maybe even a personal website, which nearly everyone did who came under her special type of research, she could sooner or later find out their innermost secrets. The work she had agreed to do for Blomkvist was altogether different. This assignment, in simple terms, was to identify 4 social security numbers based on extremely vague data. In addition, these individuals most likely died several decades ago, so probably they would not be on any computer files. Blomkvist's theory, based on the Rebecca Jacobson case, was that these individuals had fallen victim to a murderer. This meant that they should be found in various unsolved police investigations. There was no clue as to when or where these murders had taken place, except that it had to be before 1966. In terms of research, she was facing a whole new situation. So, how do I go about this? She pulled up the Google search engine and typed in the keywords Magda plus murder. This was the simplest form of research she could do. To her surprise, she made an instant breakthrough in the investigation. Her first hit was the program listings for TV Värmland in Karlstad, advertising a segment in the series Värmland Murders that was broadcast in 1999. After that, she found a brief mention in a TV listing in Värmlands Folkblad. In the series Värmland Murders, the focus now turns to Magda Lovisa Sjöberg in Ranmoträsk, a gruesome murder mystery that occupied the Karlstad police several decades ago. In April 1960, the 46-year-old farmer's wife was found murdered in the family's barn. The reporter Claes Gunnars describes the last hours of her life and the fruitless search for the killer. The murder caused a great stir at the time, and many theories have been presented about who the guilty party was. A young relative will appear on the show to talk about how his life was destroyed when he was accused of the murder. 8 p.m. She found more substantial information in the article The Lovisa Case Shook the Whole Countryside, which was published in the magazine Värmlandskultur. All of the magazine's texts had been loaded onto the net. Written with obvious glee and in a chatty and titillating tone, the article described how Lovisa Sjöberg's husband, the lumberjack Holger Sjöberg, had found his wife dead when he came home from work around 5. She had been subjected to gross sexual assault, stabbed, and finally murdered with the prongs of a pitchfork. The murder occurred in the family barn. But what aroused the most attention was the fact that the perpetrator, after committing the murder, had tied her up in a kneeling position inside a horse stall. It was later discovered that one of the animals on the farm, a cow, had suffered a stab wound on the side of its neck. Initially, the husband was suspected of the murder, but he had been in the company of his work colleagues from 6 in the morning at a clearing 25 miles from his home. It could be verified that Lovisa Sjöberg had been alive as late as 10 in the morning, when she had a visit from a woman friend. No one had seen or heard anything. The farm was 500 yards from its nearest neighbour. After dropping the husband as a suspect, the police investigation focused on the victim's 23-year-old nephew. He had repeatedly fallen foul of the law, was extremely short of cash, and many times had borrowed small sums from his aunt. The nephew's alibi was significantly weaker, and he was taken into custody for a while, but released for lack of evidence. Even so, many people in the village thought it highly probable that he was guilty. The police followed another lead. A part of the investigation concerned the search for a peddler who was seen in the area. There was also a rumour that a group of thieving gypsies had carried out a series of raids. Why they would have committed a savage, sexually related murder without stealing anything was never explained. For a time, suspicion was directed at a neighbour in the village, a bachelor who in his youth was suspected of an allegedly homosexual crime. This was back when homosexuality was still a punishable offence, and according to several statements, he had a reputation for being odd. Why someone who was supposedly homosexual would commit a sex crime against a woman was not explained either. None of these leads, or any others, led to a charge. Salander thought there was a clear link to the list in Harriet Wanger's datebook. Leviticus chapter 20, verse 16 said, "If a woman approaches any beast and lies with it, you shall kill the woman and the beast. They shall be put to death. Their blood is upon them." It couldn't be a coincidence that a farmer's wife by the name of Magda had been found murdered in a barn with her body so arranged and tied up in a horse stall. The question was, why had Harriet Wanger written down the name Magda instead of Lovisa, which was apparently the name the victim went under? If her full name had not been printed in the TV listing, Salander would have missed it. And, of course, the more important question was there a link between Rebecca's murder in 1949, the murder of Magda Lovisa in 1960, and Harriet Wanger's disappearance in 1966? On Saturday morning, Boorman took Blomqvist on an extensive tour of Norsjö. In the morning, they called on 5 former employees who lived within walking distance of Boorman's house. Everyone offered them coffee. All of them studied the photographs and shook their heads. After a simple lunch at the Boorman home, they got in the car for a drive. They visited 4 villages near Norsjö, where former employees of the carpentry shop lived. At each stop, Boorman was greeted with warmth, but no one was able to help them. Blomqvist was beginning to despair. At 4 in the afternoon, Boorman parked his car outside a typical red Västerbotten farm near Norsjövallen, just north of Norsjö, and introduced Mikael to Henning Forsman, a retired master carpenter.
"Yes, that's Assa Brenlund's lad," Forsman said as soon as Blomqvist showed him the photographs.
Bingo.
"Oh, so that's Esser's boy," Boorman said. "Esser was a buyer."
"How can I find him?"
"The lad? Well, you'll have to dig. His name was Gunnar, and he worked at the Boliden mine. He died in a blasting accident in the mid-70s.
Blomqvist's heart sank.
"But his wife is still alive, the one in the picture here. Her name is Mildred, and she lives in Bjursele."
"Bjursele?"
"It's about 6 miles down the road to Bastertresk. She lives in the long red house on the right-hand side as you're coming into the village. It's the 3rd house. I know the family well."
Hi, my name is Lisbeth Salander, and I'm writing my thesis on the criminology of violence against women in the 20th century. I'd like to visit the police district in Landskrona and read through the documents of a case from 1957. It has to do with the murder of a woman by the name of Raka Lunde. Do you have any idea where those documents are today?
Bjursala was like a poster for the Västerbotten country village. It consisted of about 20 houses, set relatively close together in a semicircle at one end of a lake. In the centre of the village was a crossroads with an arrow pointing towards Hemingon, 10.5 miles, and another pointing towards Bastertresk, 7 miles. Near the crossroads was a small bridge with a creek that Blomqvist assumed was the water, the Sel. At the height of summer it was as pretty as a postcard. He parked in the courtyard in front of a Konsum that was no longer open, almost opposite the 3rd house on the right-hand side. When he knocked on the door, no one answered. He took an hour-long walk along the road towards Hemingon. He passed the spot where the stream became rushing rapids. He met 2 cats and saw a deer, but not a single person, before he turned around. Mildred Brenlund's door was still shut. On a post near the bridge he found a peeling flyer announcing the BTCC, something that could be deciphered as the Bjursala Tukting Car Championship 2002. Tukting a car was apparently a winter sport that involved smashing up a vehicle on the ice-covered lake. He waited until 10 p.m. before he gave up and drove back to Norsjö, where he had a late dinner and then went to bed to read the denouement of Val McDermott's novel. It was grisly. At 10, Salander added one more name to Harriet Wanger's list. She did so with some hesitation. She had discovered a shortcut. At quite regular intervals, articles were published about unsolved murders, and in a Sunday supplement to the evening newspaper, she had found an article from 1999 with the headline, "Many Murderers of Women Go Free." It was a short article, but it included the names and photographs of several noteworthy murder victims. There was the Solveig case in Norrtälje, the Anita murder in Norrköping, Margareta in Helsingborg, and a number of others. The oldest case to be recounted was from the 60s, and none of the murders matched the list that Salander had been given by Blomqvist, but one case did attract her attention. In June 1962, a prostitute by the name of Leah Persson from Göteborg had gone to Uddevalla to visit her mother and her 9-year-old son, whom her mother was taking care of. On a Sunday evening, after a visit of several days, Leah had hugged her mother, said goodbye, and caught the train back to Göteborg. She was found 2 days later behind a container on an industrial site no longer in use. She had been raped, and her body had been subjected to extraordinary violence. The Leah murder aroused a great deal of attention as a summer serial story in the newspaper, but no killer had ever been identified. There was no Leah on Harriet Wanger's list, nor did the manner of her death fit with any of Harriet's Bible quotes. On the other hand, there was such a bizarre coincidence that Salander's antennae instantly buzzed. About 10 yards from where Leah's body was found lay a flower pot with a pigeon inside. Someone had tied a string round the pigeon's neck and pulled it through the hole in the bottom of the pot. Then the pot was put on a little fire that had been laid between 2 bricks. There was no certainty that this cruelty had any connection with the Leah murder. It could have been a child playing a horrible game. But the press dubbed the murder the Pigeon Murder. Salander was no Bible reader. She did not even own one. But that evening she went over to Högalid Church, and with some difficulty she managed to borrow a Bible. She sat on a park bench outside the church and read Leviticus. When she reached chapter 12, verse 8, her eyebrows went up. Chapter 12 dealt with the purification of women after childbirth. "And if she cannot afford a lamb, then she shall take 2 turtle doves and 2 young pigeons, one for a burnt offering and the other for a sin offering, and the priest shall make atonement for her, and she shall be clean." Leah could very well have been included in Harriet's date book as Leah 31208. Salander thought that no research she had ever done before had contained even a fraction of the scope of this assignment. Mildred Brenlund, remarried and now Mildred Berggren, opened the door when Blomqvist knocked around 10 on Sunday morning. The woman was much older, of course, and had by now filled out a good deal, but he recognized her at once. "Hi, my name is Mikael Blomqvist. You must be Mildred Berggren." "That's right. I'm sorry for knocking on your door like this, but I've been trying to find you, and it's rather complicated to explain." He smiled at her. "I wonder if I could come in and take up a small amount of your time." Mildred's husband and her son, who was about 35, were home, and without much hesitation she invited Blomqvist to come and sit in their kitchen. He shook hands with each of them. He had drunk more coffee during the past 24 hours than at any time in his life, but by now he had learned that in Norrland it was rude to say no. When the coffee cups were on the table, Mildred sat down and asked with some curiosity how she could help him. It was obvious that he did not easily understand her Norrshore dialect, so she switched to standard Swedish. Blomqvist took a deep breath. "This is a long and peculiar story," he said. "In September 1966 you were in Hedestad with your then husband, Gunnar Brenlund." She looked surprised. He waited for her to nod before he laid the photograph from Järnvägsgatan on the table in front of her. "When was this picture taken? Do you remember the occasion?" "Oh, my goodness," Mildred Berggren said. "That was a lifetime ago." Her present husband and son came to stand next to her to look at the picture. "We were on our honeymoon. We had driven down to Stockholm and Stigtuna and were on our way home and happened to stop somewhere. Was it in Hedestad, you said?"
"Yes, Hedestad. This photograph was taken at about 1 in the afternoon. I've been trying to find you for some time now, and it hasn't been a simple task."
"You see an old photograph of me, and then actually track me down? I can't imagine how you did it."
Blomqvist put the photograph from the car park on the table.
"I was able to find you thanks to this picture, which was taken a little later in the day."
He explained how, via the Norrshore carpentry shop, he had found Bormann, who in turn had led him to Henning Forsman in Norrshavallen.
"You must have a good reason for this long search."
"I do. This girl standing close to you in this photograph is called Harriet. That day she disappeared, and she was never seen or heard of again. The general assumption is that she fell prey to a murderer. Can I show you some more photographs?"
He took out his iBook and explained the circumstances while the computer booted up. Then he played her the series of images showing how Harriet's facial expression changed.
It was when I went through these old images that I found you standing with a camera right behind Harriet, and you seemed to be taking a picture in the direction of whatever it is she's looking at, whatever caused her to react in that way. I know that this is a really long shot, but the reason I've been looking for you is to ask you if by any miracle you still have the pictures from that day. He was prepared for Mildred Berggren to dismiss the idea and tell him that the photographs had long since vanished. Instead, she looked at him with her clear blue eyes and said, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, that of course she still had her old honeymoon pictures. She went to another room and came back after several minutes with a box in which she had stored a quantity of pictures in various albums. It took a while to find the honeymoon ones. She had taken three photographs in Hedestad. One was blurry and showed the main street. Another showed her husband at the time. The third showed the clowns in the parade. Lundqvist eagerly leaned forward. He could see a figure on the other side of the street, behind a clown. But the photograph told him absolutely nothing. Chapter 20. Tuesday, July 1st to Wednesday, July 2nd. The first thing Lundqvist did the morning he returned to Hedestad was to go to Froda's house to ask about Wanger's condition. He learned to his delight that the old man had improved quite a bit during the past week. He was weak still, and fragile, but now he could sit up in bed. His condition was no longer regarded as critical. "Thank God," he said. "I realized that I actually like him." Froda said, "I know that. And Henrik likes you too. How is Norland?"
"Successful, yet unsatisfying. I'll explain a little later. Right now I have a question."
"Go ahead."
"What realistically will happen to your interest in Millennium if Henrik dies?"
"Nothing at all. Martin will take his place on the board."
"Is there any risk, hypothetically speaking, that Martin might create problems for Millennium if I don't put a stop to the investigation of Harriet's disappearance?"
Froda gave him a sharp look. "What's happened?"
"Nothing, actually."
Mikhail told him about the conversation he had had with Martin Wanger on Midsummer Eve.
"When I was in Norsjö, Erika told me that Martin had called her and said that he thought I was very much needed back at the office."
"I understand. My guess is that Cecilia was after him. But I don't think that Martin would put pressure on you like that on his own. He's much too savvy. And remember, I'm also on the board of the little subsidiary we formed when we bought into Millennium."
"But what if a ticklish situation came up?
How would you act then?" "Contracts exist to be honored. I work for Henrik. Henrik and I have been friends for 45 years, and we are in complete agreement in such matters. If Henrik should die, it is in point of fact I, not Martin, who would inherit Henrik's share in the subsidiary. We have a contract in which we have undertaken to back Millennium for 3 years. Should Martin wish to start any mischief, which I don't believe he will, then theoretically he could put the brakes on a small number of new advertisers."
"The lifeblood of Millennium's existence."
"Yes. But look at it this way. Worrying about such trivia is a waste of time. Martin is presently fighting for his industrial survival and working 14 hours a day. He doesn't have time for anything else."
"May I ask, I know it's none of my business, what is the general condition of the corporation?"
Frodo looked grave. "We have problems."
"Yes, even a common financial reporter like myself can see that. I mean, how serious is it?"
"Off the record?"
"Between us.
We've lost 2 large orders in the electronics industry in the past few weeks, and are about to be ejected from the Russian market. In September, we're going to have to lay off 1,600 employees in Örebro and Trollhättan. Not much of a reward to give to people who've worked for the company for many years. Each time we shut down a factory, confidence in the company is further undermined."
"Martin is under pressure."
"He's pulling the load of an ox and walking on eggshells."
Lundqvist went back to his cottage and called Berger. She was not at the office, so he spoke to Malm.
"Here's the deal. Erika called when I was in Norsjö. Martin Wanger has been after and has, how shall I put it, encouraged her to propose that I start to take on editorial responsibility."
"I think you should too," Malm said.
"I know that. But the thing is, I have a contract with Henrik Wanger that I can't break. And Martin is acting on behalf of someone up here who wants me to stop what I'm doing and leave town. So his proposal amounts to an attempt to get rid of me."
"I see.
Say hi to Erica and tell her I'll come back to Stockholm when I'm finished here, not before.
I understand.
You'll start raving mad, of course, but I'll give her the message.
Krista, something is going on up here, and I have no intention of backing out.
Blomqvist knocked on Martin Wanger's door. Eva Hassel opened it and greeted him warmly.
Hi. Is Martin home?
As if in reply to the question, Martin Wanger came walking out with a briefcase in his hand. He kissed Eva on the cheek and said hello to Mikhail.
I'm on my way to the office. Do you want to talk to me?
We can do it later if you're in a hurry.
Let's hear it.
I won't be going back to Millennium's editorial board before I'm finished with the assignment that Henry gave me. I'm informing you of this now, so that you won't count on me being on the board before New Year's.
Martin Wanger teetered back and forth a bit.
I see. You think I want to get rid of you? He paused.
Mikhail, we'll have to talk about this later. I don't really have time to devote to my hobby on Millennium's board, and I wish I'd never agreed to Henrik's proposal. But believe me, I'm going to do my best to make sure that Millennium survives.
I've never had any doubt about that, Blomqvist said.
If we make an appointment for sometime next week, we can go over the finances, and I can give you my views on the matter. But my basic attitude is that Millennium cannot actually afford to have one of its key people sitting up here on Hedeby Island twiddling his thumbs. I liked the magazine, and I think we can make it stronger together, but you're crucial to that task. I've wound up in a conflict of loyalties here. Either I follow Henrik's wishes or carry out my job on Millennium's board.
Blomqvist changed into his tracksuit and went for a run out to the fortress and down to Gottfried's cabin, before he headed home at a slower pace along the water. Frodo was sitting at the garden table. He waited patiently as Mikhail drank a bottle of water and toweled the sweat from his face.
"That doesn't look so healthy in this heat."
"Oh, come on," Blomqvist said.
"I was wrong. Cecilia isn't the main person who's after Martin. It's Isabella. She's busy mobilizing the Wanger clan to tar and feather you and possibly burn you at the stake, too. She's being backed up by Birger."
"Isabella?"
"She's a malicious, petty woman who doesn't like other people in general. Right now it seems that she detests you in particular. She's spreading stories that you're a swindler who duped Henrik into hiring you, and that you got him so worked up that he had a heart attack."
"I hope no one believes that."
"There's always someone willing to believe malicious rumors."
"I'm trying to work out what happened to her daughter, and she hates me. If Harriet were my daughter, I would have reacted a bit differently."
At 2 in the afternoon, his mobile rang.
"Hello, my name is Connie Torsen, and I work at the Hedestad Courier. Do you have time to answer a few questions? We've got a tip that you're living here in Hedeby."
"Well, Herr Torsen, your tip machine is a little slow. I've been living here since the first of the year."
"I didn't know that. What are you doing in Hedestad?"
"Writing. And taking a sort of sabbatical."
"What are you working on?"
"You'll find out when I publish it."
"You were just released from prison."
"Yes."
"Do you have a view on journalists who falsify material?"
"Journalists who falsify material are idiots."
"So in your opinion, you're an idiot?"
"Why should I think that? I've never falsified material."
"But you were convicted of libel."
"So?"
Torsen hesitated long enough that Blomqvist had to give him a push.
"I was convicted of libel, not of falsifying material."
"But you published the material."
"If you're calling to discuss the judgment against me, I have no comment."
"I'd like to come out and do an interview with you."
"I have nothing to say to you on this topic."
"So you don't want to discuss the trial?"
"That's correct," he said, and hung up.
He sat thinking for a long time before he went back to his computer. Salander followed the instructions she had received and drove her Kawasaki across the bridge to Hedeby Island. She stopped at the first little house on the left. She was really out in the sticks. But as long as her employer was paying, she did not mind if she went to the North Pole. Besides, it was great to give her bike its head on a long ride up the E4. She put the bike on its stand and loosened the strap that held her overnight duffel bag in place. Blomqvist opened the door and waved to her. He came out and inspected her motorcycle with obvious astonishment. He whistled.
"You're riding a motorbike."
Salander said nothing, but she watched him intently as he touched the handlebars and tried the accelerator.
She did not like anyone touching her stuff. Then she saw his childlike, boyish smile, which she took for a redeeming feature. Most people who were into motorcycles usually laughed at her lightweight bike.
"I had a motorbike when I was 19," he said, turning to her. "Thanks for coming up. Come in and let's get you settled."
He had borrowed a camp bed from the Nielsens. Salander took a tour around the cabin, looking suspicious, but she seemed to relax when she could find no immediate signs of any insidious trap. He showed her where the bathroom was.
"In case you want to take a shower and freshen up."
"I have to change. I'm not going to wander around in my leathers."
"Okay. While you change, I'll make dinner."
He sautéed lamb chops in red wine sauce and set the table outdoors in the afternoon sun while Salander showered and changed. She came out barefoot, wearing a black camisole and a short, worn denim skirt. The food smelled good, and she put away two stout helpings. Fascinated, Blomqvist sneaked a look at the tattoos on her back.
5 + 3, Salander said. 5 cases from your Harriet's list, and 3 cases that I think should have been on the list.
Tell me.
I've only been on this for 11 days, and I haven't had a chance to dig up all the reports. In some cases, the police reports have been put in the National Archive, and in others they're still stored in the local police district. I made 3 day trips to different police districts, but I didn't have time to get to all of them. The 5 are identified.
Salander put a solid heap of paper on the kitchen table, around 500 pages. She quickly sorted the material into different stacks.
Let's take them in chronological order.
She handed Blomqvist a list. 1949, Rebecca Jacobson, Hederstad, 30112. 1954, Mari Holmberg, Kalmar, 32018. 1957, Raquel Lund, Landskrona, 32027. 1960, Magda Lovisa Schoberg, Karlstad, 32016. 1960, Liv Gustafsson, Stockholm, 32016. 1962, Leah Persson, Uddevalla, 31208. 1964, Sarah Witt, Ronneby, 32109. 1966, Lena Andersson, Uppsala, 30112.
The first case in this series is Rebecca Jacobson, 1949, the details of which you already know. The next case I found was Mari Holmberg, a 32-year-old prostitute in Kalmar, who was murdered in her apartment in October 1954. It's not clear exactly when she was killed, since her body wasn't found right away, probably 9 or 10 days later.
And how do you connect her to Harriet's list?
She was tied up and badly abused, but the cause of death was strangulation. She had a sanitary towel down her throat.
Blomqvist sat in silence for a moment, before he looked up the verse that was Leviticus chapter 20, verse 18. If a man lies with a woman having her sickness, and uncovers her nakedness, he has made naked her fountain, and she has uncovered the fountain of her blood. Both of them shall be cut off from among their people. Salander nodded.
Harriet Wanger made the same connection.
Okay. Next.
May 1957, Raquel Lund, 45. She worked as a cleaning woman and was a bit of a happy eccentric in the village. She was a fortune teller, and her hobby was doing tarot readings, palms, etc. She lived outside Landskrona in a house a long way from anywhere, and she was murdered there sometime early in the morning. She was found naked and tied to a laundry drying frame in her back garden with her mouth taped shut. Cause of death was a heavy rock being repeatedly thrown at her. She had countless contusions and fractures.
Jesus Christ. Elizabeth, this is fucking disgusting.
It gets worse. The initials R.L. are correct. You found the Bible quote?
Overly explicit. A man or a woman who is a medium or a wizard shall be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood shall be upon them.
Then there's Schoberg in Ranmar outside Karlstad. She's the one Harriet listed as Magda. Her full name was Magda Lovisa, but people called her Lovisa.
Blomqvist listened while Salander recounted the bizarre details of the Karlstad murder. When she lit a cigarette, he pointed at the pack and she pushed it over to him.
So the killer attacked the animal too.
The Leviticus verse says that if a woman has sex with an animal, both must be killed.
The likelihood of this woman having sex with a cow must be, well, non-existent.
The verse can be read literally. It's enough that she approaches the animal, which a farmer's wife would undeniably do every day.
Understood.
The next case on Harriet's list is Sarah. I've identified her as Sarah Vitt, 37, living in Ronneby. She was murdered in January 1964, found tied to her bed, subjected to aggravated sexual assault, but the cause of death was asphyxiation. She was strangled. The killer also started a fire, with the probable intention of burning the whole house down to the ground. But part of the fire went out by itself, and the rest was taken care of by the fire service, who were there in a very short time.
And the connection?
Listen to this. Sarah Witt was both the daughter of a pastor and married to a pastor. Her husband was away that weekend.
And the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by playing the harlot, profanes her father. She shall be burned with fire. Okay. That fits on the list. You said you'd found more cases.
I found three other women who were murdered under such similarly strange circumstances, and they could have been on Harriet's list. The first is a young woman named Liv Gustafson. She was 22 and lived in Farsta. She was a horse-loving girl. She rode in competitions and was quite a promising talent. She also owned a small pet shop with her sister. She was found in the shop. She had worked late on the bookkeeping and was there alone. She must have let the killer in voluntarily. She was raped and strangled to death.
That doesn't sound quite like Harriet's list, does it?
Not exactly, if it weren't for one thing. The killer concluded his barbarities by shoving a parakeet up her vagina and then let all the animals out into the shop. Cats, turtles, white mice, rabbits, birds, even the fish in the aquarium. So it was quite an appalling scene her sister encountered in the morning.
Blomqvist made a note.
She was murdered in August 1960, 4 months after the murder of the farmer's wife, Magda Lovisa, in Karlstad. In both instances, there were women who worked professionally with animals, and in both cases there was an animal sacrifice. The cow in Karlstad may have survived, but I can imagine it would be difficult to stab a cow to death with a knife. A parakeet is more straightforward. And besides, there was an additional animal sacrifice.
What? Salander told the story of the pigeon murder of Leah Persson. Blomqvist sat for so long in silence and in thought that even Salander grew impatient.
I'll buy your theory, he said at last. There's one case left.
A case that I discovered by chance. I don't know how many I may have missed.
Tell me about it.
February 1966 in Uppsala. The victim was a 17-year-old gymnast called Lena Andersson. She disappeared after a class party and was found 3 days later in a ditch on the Uppsala plain, quite a way out of town. She had been murdered somewhere else, and her body dumped there. This murder got a lot of attention in the media, but the true circumstances surrounding her death were never reported. The girl had been grotesquely tortured. I read the pathologist's report. She was tortured with fire. Her hands and breasts were atrociously burned, and she had been burned repeatedly at various spots all over her body. They found paraffin stains on her which showed that candles had been used, but her hands were so charred that they must have been held over a more powerful fire. Finally, the killer sawed off her head and tossed it next to the body.
Blomqvist blanched.
Good Lord, he said. I can't find any Bible quote that fits, but there are several passages that deal with a fire offering and a sin offering, and in some places it's recommended that the sacrificial animal, most often a bull, be cut up in such a way that the head is severed from the fat. Fire also reminds me of the first murder of Rebecca here in Hedestad.
Towards evening, when the mosquitoes began to swarm, they cleared off the garden table and moved to the kitchen to go on with their talk. The fact that you didn't find an exact Bible quotation doesn't mean much. It's not a matter of quotations. This is a grotesque parody of what is written in the Bible. It's more like associations to quotations pulled out of context.
I agree. It isn't even logical. Take, for example, the quote that both have to be cut off from their people if someone has sex with a girl who's having her period. If that's interpreted literally, the killer should have committed suicide.
So where does all this lead? Blomqvist wondered aloud.
Your Harriet either had quite a strange hobby, or else she must have known that there was a connection between the murders.
Between 1949 and 1966, and maybe before and after as well. The idea that an insanely sick, sadistic serial killer were slaughtering women for at least 17 years without anyone seeing a connection sounds utterly unbelievable to me. Salander pushed back her chair and poured more coffee from the pot on the stove. She lit a cigarette. Mikhail cursed himself and stole another from her.
"No, it's not so unbelievable," she said,
holding up one finger.
"We have several dozen unsolved murders of women in Sweden during the 20th century. That professor of criminology, Persson, said once on TV that serial killers are very rare in Sweden, but that probably we have had some that were never caught."
She held up another finger.
"These murders were committed over a very long period of time and all over the country. Two occurred close together in 1960, but the circumstances were quite different. A farmer's wife in Karlstad and a 22-year-old in Stockholm."
Three fingers.
"There is no immediately apparent pattern. The murders were carried out at different places, and there is no real signature, but there are certain things that do recur. Animals, fire, aggravated sexual assault, and, as you pointed out, a parody of biblical quotations. But it seems that not one of the investigating detectives interpreted any of the murders in terms of the Bible."
Blomqvist was watching her. With her slender body, her black camisole, the tattoos, and the rings piercing her face, Salander looked out of place, to say the least, in a guest cottage in Hedeby. When he tried to be sociable over dinner, she was taciturn to the point of rudeness. But when she was working, she sounded like a professional to her fingertips. Her apartment in Stockholm might look as if a bomb had gone off in it, but mentally Salander was extremely well organized. "It's hard to see the connection between a prostitute in Uddevalla who's killed in an industrial yard, and a pastor's wife who is strangled in Ronneby and has her house set on fire. If you don't have the key that Harriet gave us, that is."
"Which leads to the next question," Salander said.
"How on earth did Harriet get mixed up in all this? A 16-year-old girl who lived in a really sheltered environment."
"There's only one answer," Salander said. "There must be some connection to the Wanger family."
By 11 that night they had gone over the series of murders and discussed the conceivable connections and the tiny details of similarity and difference so often that Blomqvist's head was spinning. He rubbed his eyes and stretched and asked Salander if she felt like a walk. Her expression suggested that she thought such practices were a waste of time, but she agreed. Blomqvist advised her to change into long trousers because of the mosquitoes. They strolled past the small boat harbour and then under the bridge and out towards Martin Wanger's point. Blomqvist pointed out the various houses and told her about the people who lived in them. He had some difficulty when they came to Cecilia Wanger's house. Salander gave him a curious look. They passed Martin Wanger's motor yacht and reached the point, and there they sat on a rock and shared a cigarette.
"There's one more connection," Blomqvist said suddenly. "Maybe you've already thought of it."
"What?"
"Their names."
Salander thought for a moment and shook her head.
"They're all biblical names."
"Not true," she said. "Where is there a Liv or Lene in the Bible?"
"They're there. Liv means to live, in other words, Eva. And come on, what's Lena short for?"
Salander grimaced in annoyance. He had been quicker than she was. She did not like that.
"Magdalena," she said.
"The whore, the first woman, the Virgin Mary. They're all there in this group. This is so freaky it'd make a psychologist's head spin. But there's something else I thought of with regard to the names."
Salander waited patiently.
"They're obviously all traditional Jewish names. The Wanger family has had more than its share of fanatical anti-Semites, Nazis, and conspiracy theorists. The only time I met Harold Wanger, he was standing in the road, snarling that his own daughter was a whore. He certainly has problems with women."
When they got back to the cabin, they made a midnight snack and heated up the coffee. Mikhail took a look at the almost 500 pages that Dragan Armansky's favourite researcher had produced for him.
"You've done a fantastic job of digging up these facts in such a short time," he said.
"Thanks. And thanks also for being nice enough to come up here and report on it."
"What happens now?"
Salander wanted to know.
"I'm going to talk to Dirk Froder tomorrow and arrange for your fee to be paid."
"That wasn't what I meant."
Blomqvist looked at her.
"Well, I reckon the job I hired you for is done," he said.
"I'm not done with this."
Blomqvist leaned back against the kitchen wall and met her gaze. He couldn't read anything at all in her eyes. For half a year he had been working alone on Harriet's disappearance, and here was another person, an experienced researcher, who grasped the implications. He made the decision on impulse. "I know. This story has got under my skin, too. I'll talk to Froda. We'll hire you for a week or two more as a research assistant. I don't know if he'll want to pay the same rate he pays to Armansky, but we should be able to arrange a basic living wage for you." Salander suddenly gave him a smile. She had no wish to be shut out, and would have gladly done the job for free.
"I'm falling asleep," she said.
And without further ado, she went to her room and closed the door. 2 minutes later, she opened the door and put out her head.
"I think you're wrong. It's not an insane serial killer who read his Bible wrong. It's just a communal garden bastard who hates women."
Chapter 21. Thursday, July 3rd to Thursday, July 10th. Salander was up before Blomqvist, around 6. She put on some water for coffee and went to take a shower. When Blomqvist woke at 7:30, she was reading his summary of the Harriet Wanger case on his iBook. He came out to the kitchen with a towel round his waist, rubbing the sleep out of his eyes.
"There's coffee on the stove," she said.
He looked over her shoulder.
"That document was password protected, damn it," he said.
She turned and peered up at him.
"It takes 30 seconds to download a program from the net that can crack Word's encryption protection."
"We need to have a talk on the subject of what's yours and what's mine," he said, and went to take a shower.
When he came back, Salander had turned off his computer and put it back in its place in his office. She had booted up her own PowerBook. Blomqvist felt sure that she had already transferred the contents of his computer to her own. Salander was an information junkie with a delinquent child's take on morals and ethics. He had just sat down to breakfast when there was a knock at the front door. Martin Wanger looked so solemn that for a second Blomqvist thought he had come to bring the news of his uncle's death.
"No, Henrik's condition is the same as yesterday. I'm here for a quite different reason. Could I come in for a moment?"
Blomqvist let him in, introducing him to my research assistant, Lisbeth Salander. She gave the captain of industry barely a glance and a quick nod before she went back to her computer. Martin Wanger greeted her automatically, but looked so distracted that he hardly seemed to notice her. Blomqvist poured him a cup of coffee and invited him to have a seat.
"What's this all about?" "You don't subscribe to the Hedderstad Courier?"
"No, but sometimes I see it at Suzanne's Bridge Café."
"Then you haven't read this morning's paper."
"You make it sound as if I ought to." Martin Wanger put the day's paper on the table in front of him. He had been given 2 columns on the front page, continued on page 4. "Convicted libel journalist hiding here." A photograph, taken with a telephoto lens from the church hill on the other side of the bridge, showed Blomqvist coming out of the cottage. The reporter, Thorsen, had cobbled together a scurrilous piece. He recapitulated the Venestrom affair and explained that Blomqvist had left Millennium in disgrace, and that he had recently served a prison term. The article ended with the usual line that Blomqvist had declined to comment to the Hedderstad Courier. Every self-respecting resident of Hedderstad was put on notice that an Olympic-class shit from Stockholm was skulking around the area. None of the claims in the article were libelous, but they were slanted to present Blomqvist in an unflattering light. The layout and type style was of the kind that such newspapers used to discuss political terrorists. Millennium was described as a magazine with low credibility, bent on agitation, and Blomqvist's book on financial journalism was presented as a collection of controversial claims about other, more respected journalists.
"Mikhail, I don't have words to express what I felt when I read this article. It's repulsive."
"It's a put-up job," Blomqvist said calmly.
"I hope you understand that I didn't have the slightest thing to do with this. I choked on my morning coffee when I read it."
"Then who did?"
"I made some calls. This Thorsen is a summer work experience kid. He did the piece on orders from Berger."
"I thought Berger had no say in the newsroom. After all, he is a councillor and political figure."
"Technically he has no influence, but the editor-in-chief of the Courier is Gunnar Kalman, Ingrid's son, who's part of the Johan Wanger branch of the family. Birger and Gunnar have been close for many years.
I see.
Thorsen will be fired forthwith.
How old is he?
To tell you the truth, I don't know. I've never met him.
Don't fire him. When he called me, he sounded like a very young and inexperienced reporter.
This can't be allowed to pass without consequences.
If you want my opinion, the situation seems a bit absurd when the editor-in-chief of a publication owned by the Wanger family goes on the attack against another publication in which Henrik Wanger is a part-owner, and on whose board you sit. Your editor, Karlmann, is attacking you and Henrik.
I see what you mean, and I ought to lay the blame where it belongs.
Karlmann is a part-owner in the corporation and has always taken pot shots at me, but this seems more like Birger's revenge because you had a run-in with him at the hospital. You're a thorn in his side.
I believe it. That's why I think Thorsen is the last person to blame. It takes a lot for an intern to say no when the boss instructs him to write something in a certain way.
I could demand that you be given an apology tomorrow.
Better not.
It would just turn into a long, drawn-out squabble that would make the situation worse.
So you don't think I should do anything?
It wouldn't be any use. Karlmann would kick up a fuss, and in the worst case, you'd be painted as a villain who, in his capacity as owner, is trying to stamp on the freedom of expression.
Pardon me, Mikhail, but I don't agree with you. As a matter of fact, I also have the right to express my opinion. My view is that this article stinks, and I intend to make my own point of view clear. However, reluctantly, I'm Henrik's replacement on Millennium's board, and in that role I'm not going to let an offensive article like this one pass unchallenged.
Fair enough.
So I'm going to demand the right to respond, and if I make Karlmann look like an idiot, he has only himself to blame.
You must do what you believe is right.
For me, it's also important that you absolutely understand that I have nothing whatsoever to do with this vitriolic attack.
I believe you, Blomqvist said.
Besides, I didn't really want to bring this up now, but this just serves to illustrate what we've already discussed. It's important to reinstall you on Millennium's editorial board so that we can show a united front to the world. As long as you're away, the gossip will continue. I believe in Millennium, and I'm convinced that we can win this fight together.
I see your point, but now it's my turn to disagree with you. I can't break my contract with Henrik, and the fact is that I wouldn't want to break it. You see, I really like him. And this thing with Harriet.
Yes?
I know it's a running sore for you, and I realize that Henrik has been obsessed with it for many years. Just between the two of us, I do love Henrik, and he is my mentor, but when it comes to Harriet, he's almost off his rocker.
When I started this job, I couldn't help thinking that it was a waste of time, but I think we're on the verge of a breakthrough, and that it might now be possible to know what really happened.
Blomqvist read doubt in Martin Wanger's eyes. At last he made a decision.
Okay. In that case, the best thing we can do is to solve the mystery of Harriet as quickly as possible. I'll give you all the support I can so that you finish the work to your satisfaction, and, of course, Henrik's, and then return to Millennium.
Good.
So I won't have to fight with you, too.
No, you won't. You can ask for my help whenever you run into a problem. I'll make damn sure that Birger won't put any sort of obstacles in your way, and I'll try to talk to Cecilia to calm her down.
Thank you. I need to ask her some questions, and she's been resisting my attempts at conversation for a month now.
Martin Wanger laughed.
Perhaps you have other issues to iron out, but I won't get involved in that.
They shook hands. Salander had listened to the conversation. When Martin Wanger left, she reached for the Hedestad Courier and scanned the article. She put the paper down without making any comment. Blomqvist sat in silence, thinking. Gunnar Karlmann was born in 1948 and would have been 18 in 1966. He was one of the people on the island when Harriet disappeared. After breakfast, he asked his research assistant to read through the police report. He gave her all the photographs of the accident as well as the long summary of Wanger's own investigations. Blomqvist then drove to Froda's house and asked him kindly to draw up an agreement for Salander as a research assistant for the next month. By the time he returned to the cottage, Salander had decamped the garden and was immersed in the police report. Blomqvist went in to heat up the coffee. He watched her through the kitchen window. She seemed to be skimming, spending no more than 10 or 15 seconds on each page. She turned the pages mechanically, and Blomqvist was amazed at her lack of concentration. It made no sense, since her own report was so meticulous. He took 2 cups of coffee and joined her at the garden table.
Your notes were done before you knew we were looking for a serial killer.
That's true. I simply wrote down questions I wanted to ask Henrik and some other things. It was quite unstructured. Up until now, I've really been struggling in the dark trying to write a story. A chapter in the autobiography of Henrik Wanger.
And now?
In the past, all the investigations focused on Hedeby Island. Now I'm sure that the story, the sequence of events that ended in her disappearance, started in Hedestad. That shifts the perspective. Salander said,
It was amazing what you discovered with the pictures.
Blomqvist was surprised. Salander did not seem the type to throw compliments around, and he felt flattered. On the other hand, from a purely journalistic point of view, it was quite an achievement.
It's your turn to fill in the details. How did it go with that picture you were chasing up in Norshire?
You mean you didn't check the images in my computer?
There wasn't time. I needed to read the resumes, your situation reports to yourself.
Blomqvist started his iBook and clicked on the photograph folder. It's fascinating. The visit to Norshire was a sort of progress, but it was also a disappointment. I found the picture, but it doesn't tell us much. That woman, Mildred Berggren, had saved all her holiday pictures in albums. The picture I was looking for was one of them. It was taken on cheap colour film, and after 37 years the print was incredibly faded, with a strong yellow tinge. But would you believe she still had the negative in a shoebox? She let me borrow all the negatives from Hedestad, and I've scanned them in. This is what Harriet saw. He clicked on an image which now had the file name Harriet/BD-19.EPS. Salander immediately understood his dismay. She saw an unfocused image that showed clowns in the foreground of the Children's Day parade. In the background could be seen the corner of Sundström's haberdashery. About 10 people were standing on the pavement in front of Sundström's. I think this is the person she saw. Partly because I tried to triangulate what she was looking at. Judging by the angle that her face was turned, I made a drawing of the crossroads there, and partly because this is the only person who seems to be looking straight into the camera, meaning that, perhaps, he was staring at Harriet. What Salander saw was a blurry figure standing a little bit behind the spectators, almost in the side street. He had on a dark padded jacket with a red patch on the shoulders and dark trousers, possibly jeans. Blomqvist zoomed in so that the figure from the waist up filled the screen. The photograph became instantly fuzzier still. It's a man. He's about 5'11", normal build. He has dark blonde, semi-long hair and is clean-shaven, but it's impossible to make out his facial features or even estimate his age. He could be anywhere between his teens and middle age.
You could manipulate the image.
I have manipulated the image, damn it. I even sent a copy to the image processing wizard at Millennium. Blomqvist clicked up a new shot. This is the absolute best I can get out of it. The camera is simply too lousy and the distance too far.
Have you shown the picture to anyone? Someone might recognize the man's bearing, or...
I showed it to Froda. He has no idea who the man is.
Herr Froda probably isn't the most observant person in Hedestad.
No, but I'm working for him and Henrik Wanger. I want to show the picture to Henrik before I cast the net wider.
Perhaps he's nothing more than a spectator.
That's possible. But he managed to trigger a strange response from Harriet. During the next several days, Blomqvist and Salander worked on the Harriet case virtually every waking moment. Salander went on reading the police report, rattling off one question after another. There could only be one truth, and each vague answer or uncertainty led to more intense interrogation. They spent one whole day examining timetables for the cast of characters at the scene of the accident on the bridge. Salander became more and more of an enigma to him. Despite the fact that she only skimmed the documents in the report, she always seemed to settle on the most obscure and contradictory details. They took a break in the afternoons, when the heat made it unbearable out in the garden. They would swim in the channel, or walk up to the terrace at Suzanne's Bridge Café. Suzanne now treated Blomqvist with an undisguised coolness. He realized that Salander looked barely legal, and she was obviously living at his cottage, and that, in Suzanne's eyes, made him a dirty old middle-aged man. It was not pleasant. Blomqvist went out every evening for a run. Salander made no comment when he returned out of breath to the cottage. Running was obviously not her thing.
I'm over 40,
he said. I have to exercise to keep from getting too fat around the middle.
I see.
Don't you ever exercise?
I box once in a while.
You box?
Yeah, you know, with gloves.
What weight do you box in? He said, when he emerged from the shower.
None at all. I spar a little now and then against the guys in a club in Cirta.
Why is that no surprise? He thought. But at least she had told him something about herself. He knew no basic facts about her. How did she come to be working for Armansky? What sort of education did she have? What did her parents do? As soon as Blomqvist tried to ask about her life, she shut up like a clam, answered in single syllables, or ignored him. One afternoon, Salander suddenly put down a binder, frowning.
What do you know about Otto Falk, the pastor?
Not much. I met the present incumbent a few times earlier in the year, and she told me that Falk lives in some geriatric home in Hedestad. Alzheimer's.
Where did he come from?
From Hedestad. He studied in Uppsala.
He was unmarried, and Harriet hung out with him.
Why do you ask?
I'm just saying that Morell went pretty easy on him in the interview.
In the 60s, pastors enjoyed a considerably different status in society. It was natural for him to live out here on the island, close to the power brokers, so to speak.
I wonder how carefully the police searched the parsonage. In the photographs, it looks like it was a big wooden house, and there must have been plenty of places to hide a body for a while.
That's true. But there's nothing in the material to indicate that he would have any connection to the serial murders, or to Harriet's disappearance.
Actually, there is,
Salander said, with a wry smile.
First of all, he was a pastor, and pastors more than anyone else have a special relationship to the Bible. Second, he was the last person known to have seen and talked with Harriet.
But he went down to the scene of the accident and stayed there for several hours. He's in lots of the pictures, especially during the time when Harriet must have vanished.
All right, I can't crack his alibi, but I was actually thinking about something else. This story is about a sadistic killer of women.
So?
I had a little time to myself this spring and read quite a bit about sadists in a rather different context. One of the things I read was an FBI manual. It claimed that a striking portion of convicted serial killers come from dysfunctional homes and tortured animals in their childhood. Some of the convicted American serial killers were also arrested for arson. Tortured animals and arson crop up in several of Harriet's murder cases. But what I was really thinking about was the fact that the parsonage burned down in the late 70s.
It's a long shot, Blomqvist said.
Elizabeth nodded.
Agreed. But I find nothing in the police report about the cause of the fire, and it would be very interesting to know if there were other unexplained fires hereabouts in the 60s. It would also be worth checking to see if there were any cases of animal abuse or mutilation in the area back then.
When Salander went to bed, on her seventh night in Hedeby, she was mildly irritated with Blomqvist. For almost a week, she had spent practically every waking minute with him. Normally, 7 minutes of another person's company was enough to give her a headache, so she set things up to live as a recluse. She was perfectly content as long as people left her in peace. Unfortunately, society was not very smart or understanding. She had to protect herself from social authorities, child welfare authorities, guardianship authorities, tax authorities, police, curators, psychologists, psychiatrists, teachers and bouncers who, apart from the guys watching the door at Kvarnen, who by this time knew who she was, would never let her into the bar even though she was 25. There was a whole army of people who seemed not to have anything better to do than to try to disrupt her life, and if they were given the opportunity to correct the way she had chosen to live it. It did no good to cry, she had learned that early on. She had also learned that every time she tried to make someone aware of something in her life, the situation just got worse. Consequently, it was up to her to solve her problems by herself, using whatever methods she deemed necessary. Something that Advocate Bjurman had found out the hard way. Blomqvist had the same tiresome habit as everyone else, poking around in her life and asking questions. On the other hand, he did not react at all like most other men she had met. When she ignored his questions, he simply shrugged and left her in peace. Astounding. Her immediate move when she got hold of his iBook that first morning had naturally been to transfer all the information to her own computer. That way it was okay if he dumped her from the case,
she would still have access to the material. She had expected a furious outburst when he appeared for his breakfast. Instead, he had looked almost resigned, muttered something sarcastic, and gone off to the shower. Then he began discussing what she had read.